From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. A Republican former governor endorses a Democrat for president today.
He saw a lot of more divisiveness and what he described as a president who's only focused on governing for his core constituency.
Michigan's political world baked into an upside-down cake. We've got more on Rick Snyder's endorsement of Joe Biden coming up. Plus, Detroit's child care centers in freefall.
So I am licensed for 60 children. And right now, currently, we have approximately that come every day, about 23.
Can anything be done to shore them up? And General Motors makes an unlikely ally in Honda.
This is the new frontier. It's costly, and there's not a return on investment yet. So companies are pairing up.
Those stories and much more coming up on today's edition of Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. General Motors and Honda have signed a deal to explore sharing vehicle parts. Later in the show today, we'll explore what this says about the future of automotive production. We'll be talking with analyst Michelle Krebs later in the show, but first, Joe Biden picked up a cross-party endorsement today from former Michigan Governor Rick Snyder. As Democratic organizers look to turn the tide for this year's presidential race, one voting bloc on their minds are moderate Republicans, people who've maybe had enough drama for 1 4-year period, but may have never voted for a Democrat, or at least not for a while. Is Republican Rick Snyder the man to overcome their reservations about a Democratic candidate for president? With us to discuss this and other topsy-turvy news is Chad Livengood, senior editor at Crain's Detroit. Chad, welcome back to Stateside.
Thanks for having me, April.
So you had a conversation with Rick Snyder today.
I did, yes. Talked to the former governor. He's somewhat been in seclusion of sorts, living out his retirement now on Gun Lake in Allegan County at his family's home there, and has kept a really low profile, and particularly in politics. He has made a policy not to comment on any policy or decision making of the current governor, Gretchen Whitmer. He's until now really has not said anything about politics in general. So this endorsement of Joe Biden and also very pointed criticism of President Trump, calling him a bully and someone who lacks a moral compass. This is pretty strong words from Rick Snyder, who has always shied away from getting into the politics of things. And so for him to wade into the cauldron of 2020 presidential politics caught some attention today.
Right. Snyder actually refused to endorse a candidate back in 2016, and Donald Trump made him a bit of a target for the lack of enthusiasm. Did he tell you anything about why he felt it was important to go public this year?
He said that Donald Trump's divisiveness has really rankled him. Governor Snyder went to Trump's inauguration, and he sat out there in the mall in Washington and sort of expected to see some type of a unity speech that we normally see from new presidents at inaugurations, and said he saw a lot of more divisiveness and what he described as a president who was only focused on governing for his core constituency. And not all of the people. And he said that, he criticized the president, said he hasn't really grown into the job or really taken seriously the work that needs to be done in the leadership. And he just was very praising of Vice President Joe Biden's record of public service. One of the things he told me is he's got a lot of feedback already today from people saying, I'll never vote for that socialist Joe Biden. And Rick Snyder replied to me that Joe Biden's not a socialist.
Were you very surprised that Snyder decided to come out and say something right now?
Yeah, a little bit. He has been, like I said, very under the radar. Some of that has to do with his record and the disaster of the Flint water crisis. There's still really a stain on his governorship. He has not really talked about it. In fact, I asked him today if he wanted to comment about the recent settlement of the $600 million, and he declined. I also asked him, did he vote for Donald Trump in 2016, which is a question that befuddled Capitol reporters for weeks on end, months on end in 2016. And he said, he reminded me he never has said that publicly. And quote, I'm going to stick to that. I just stayed out of that election.
Right. Snyder's Lieutenant Governor, Brian Calley, who currently runs a small business group, endorsed Donald Trump a few months ago. And, you know, one might say that Calley and Snyder are cut from a similar cloth. They're both cerebral guys, convivial Republicans, fiscal conservatives, maybe a little more middle of the road on social issues. What do you make of the division in endorsements?
Well, Calley, this has been a long road for him on this on Donald Trump. He famously unendorsed Donald Trump in the 2016 election on what I've referred to as Billy Bush weekend, where the Hollywood Access tape surfaced of Donald Trump making sexist and remarks about his ability to touch women however he wants and when he wants. And Brian Calley was a prominent Republican who revoked his rescinded his own endorsement and then never lived live that down, essentially, in Republican politics. It was one of the reasons Brian Calley had almost no chance of winning the Republican nomination for governor in 2018. Bill Schuette, the attorney general, who flipped from Jeb Bush's camp to Trump's camp pretty quickly, he never let Calley live that down in that primary campaign. Now Calley's in a different position. He's essentially a lobbyist for the Small Business Association of Michigan, and he's at a different stage in his life and career. He's much younger than Rick Snyder. Obviously, Rick Snyder made you know, millions of dollars in the private sector before he became governor, mm-hmm. and doesn't really need to earn a living anymore. And Brian Calley is out potentially out there as a potential candidate for office again someday. And so you just don't really know how long Trumpism is going to live past the presidency of Donald Trump.
So basically, Brian Calley might actually want to run for office as a Republican again in Michigan, and Rick Snyder's probably not going to do that.
Exactly.
Yeah. Snyder is not exactly propped up as a party leader here in Michigan. In fact, I saw that Laura Cox, the current head of the Michigan GOP, wondered aloud on Twitter why anyone would care what Rick Snyder thinks. And as you mentioned, Democrats have made him a bit of a punching bag over the Flint water crisis. Do you think the endorsement of Rick Snyder does anything significant for Joe Biden? Do you think it changes any hearts and minds?
Yeah, Laura Cox called him Mr. Irrelevant, and Laura comes from Livonia, Michigan, and Livonia is the city to sort of watch. The longtime Republicans who have been maybe moderate, middle-of-the-road Republicans have been really turned off by Donald Trump. We saw that in the 2018 election with the pink wave that put Gretchen Whitmer in the governor's office and swept women in particular across the board into the legislature, into Congress, in Oakland and Macomb County, the suburbs of Detroit that are so crucial to winning Michigan. And so there is a voter out there that Rick Snyder is speaking to has been probably pretty quiet, probably doesn't weigh in about politics on Facebook, but maybe has been reserved enough that they're just going to wait to go to the ballot box and punch the ticket for Joe Biden and try to oust Donald Trump from and make him a one-term president.
I wanted to ask you about another political flip, this one in the other direction. This week, Macomb County Executive Mark Hackle, a Democrat, is supporting an effort to curb Democratic Governor Gretchen Whitmer's executive powers as she has exercised them during COVID. So this is a sort of lower level Democrat within the party going after the top elected official in the state. You spoke to Mark Hackle this week about it. Let's take a listen.
Let's just say I've been asked to just kind of support whatever decision I made. If you remember early on, I supported her initial try to figure out how do we get roads funded. I supported when she was trying to push through with her budget. You know, I was the one that was out there trying to figure out how do we get this going and supporting her all the way. But then when I started asking questions and I'm being asked not to continue to just support blindly without asking questions and wanting better understanding of what's going on, that's when it got a little contentious.
Chad Livengood, this issue is red meat for Republicans who support Donald Trump. They've been very critical of Governor Whitmer. It may be that Mark Hackle gets some nods from Republicans, but do you get any sense that Whitmer's executive powers have been an issue among
other Democratic moderates? I mean, are there Democrats beyond Macomb County who might be on board this and think the state has been being too heavy-handed?
I definitely think there are voters out there, middle-of-the-road voters, who have started to question a lot of the intent and the reasoning and rationale behind some of these executive orders. And one of the flashpoints has been these businesses that are continuing to be closed, like bowling alleys and hockey rinks and movie theaters, because there hasn't been any real broad explanation about what exactly is more unsafe about those type of facilities than going in and pulling a slot machine handle at a Greektown casino, which the governor has been allowing now for 4 weeks. And so that's where you get a lot of Hackle is tapping into a sentiment of the voters that probably voted for Gretchen Whitmer or have at least given her high marks, and certainly her approval rating has remained high, and her supporters will point to that. But this, as this pandemic has lagged on, there have not been a lot of explanations about a lot of the policies, and I think Hackle is kind of reflecting the frustration with that you see across the board in different communities of the state, and obviously different sectors and halls of power.
Just like Snyder with the Republican Party, Mark Hackle isn't exactly beloved among Democrats. Do you think that his endorsement does anything significant?
I think it has some staying power in Macomb County, certainly. And it plays well to his base, which is very bipartisan. And Mark Hackle has been kind of an estranged Democrat for some time. Of course, there may be some motivation from Democrats to say, hey, next in 2022, it's the time to take Mark Hackle out in a primary. Although Mark Hackle has seemingly had a lot of staying power as both a county executive and the sheriff there. But there definitely could be some crowds this plays to. One thing that he said to me in the third person was that Mark Hackle is not trying to run for governor, and he said Mark Hackle is not angry at the governor, we will see about that. Mark Hackle is also known to float his name or the potential for run for governor. He's done it a couple times, most recently back in 2017. And so we'll kind of have to sort of see how the politics play out on this one.
Chad Livengood, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
In just a minute, we're going to talk to a child care provider in Detroit who's feeling the financial pressure as the pandemic continues and parents remain at home with or without work. That's right around the corner. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Ask parents how they're doing right now, and you're likely to get a spine-rattling sigh. If children are elementary age or younger, maybe even if they're not, parents right now are very worried about child care. Michigan's child care providers are at a critical stage. Many have been cleared to reopen with restrictions, but the business model is in crisis. With us today is one of Detroit's child care professionals, Nina Hodge, the owner of Above and Beyond Learning. Nina, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you for having me this afternoon.
We're also speaking with Kobe Levin, Chalkbeat Detroit reporter who's been covering child care. Kobe, nice to talk to you again.
Thanks for having me.
Nina, let's start out with just where things are from where you stand. I'm sure that a lot of things have changed since March when the pandemic began. Could you maybe start us out with what's the difference in the number of kids who you're caring for right now and the number of staff who you have involved in the business at the moment?
So I am licensed for 60 children. And right now, currently, we have approximately that come every day about 23. And that's not on a daily basis. It might be 2 or 3 days they might miss out the week.
Mm. How close to capacity were you running before the pandemic began?
I was full capacity at 60 children. With the waiting list.
Oh, so that's fewer than half of the kids who were with you before showing up right now.
That would be correct. Because a lot of the parents, too, they might be working part-time now. They're not even probably working full-time themselves. So the parents may keep them at home with them, or they may out here seeking for unemployment too at the same time.
Oh my gosh.
So that caused my enrollment going up and down, fluctuation.
Have you had to lay people off?
So to be honest, not to lay off, I'm looking for employees. I need help for even the 23, 25 that we had. I hired a lot of high school students that came. So I was really grateful to have four high school students that showed up and worked very well with the children.
So would I be right in guessing that for folks who might have considered, you know, folks who'd worked as staff for you before, that they might be in a position where they look at their unemployment check and they look at what they'd receive for going back to work, and they just sort of ask themselves if it's worth the risk?
So that's, yeah, 2 points to that, because they look at it and say, I'm getting more money staying home. And then the second one is that I have children at home, so I think I should stay at home with my children instead of going out taking care of other children. And one of my staff members lost her family member. She lost her husband and she lost her mother-in-law. So they were back to back, and she was my cook. And so my high school student came in and did my cooking, which was not on the stove, but just making great sandwiches and things.
That's a lot. That's just a lot to be dealing with right now. How long would you say your business can continue to operate with conditions being as they are?
So the payroll, that's the issue right there. So you have fluctuations. So if the kid is not here, I can't bill what the hourly wage that I receive payment from. Instead of knowing if the child comes 2 or 3 days, I should be able to bill weekly, like enrollment. So if I have a tuition person that pays me $200 a week, even if he missed a day, I got the enrollment fee. Versus if the state pays me by the hour, and so I'm losing out of money, which I have to have these staff here, and I don't want to send a staff person home because they don't want their checks fluctuate.
Kobe, how does Nina's situation compare with what you've heard from other providers that you've talked to?
So you can talk to just about as many providers as you want across the Detroit area and the state, and you're likely to hear one thing, which is the math doesn't work. Providers, for the most part, are private businesses. This is not like the K-12 system for the most part. They depend on the money that they bring in for students who show up just on a weekly basis. They don't have a steady income if students stop showing up. So with decreased enrollment during the pandemic, they just can't make ends meet. I talked to numerous childcare providers over the last couple of weeks who are saying that without further help, they're looking at closing their doors. And mind you, they're operating in parts of the state that already have a serious childcare shortage. So it's a really, really tough situation right now for providers and for parents, you know, who rely on them.
I mean, I suppose this question could be to either of you. If it's happening in Detroit right now, can we assume this is also happening across the state?
Absolutely, across the state, because it's just the fluctuation and everything. And then the job market at the same time for the parents looking for jobs. And it takes a while, if I'm in this demographic here, for them to even get signed up with DHS, Department of Human Health Services. So it's going to take 30 to 45 days just for them to get signed up. So they have the job, but they can't even get the child care because they got to wait for someone to get them signed up.
Right. Kobe, have you heard of any child care providers going under yet?
Yes, there are folks who've closed their doors, who've called it quits. There's a really large number of providers who just aren't open right now, and who are asking themselves, you know, how much longer can I make it? We've seen across the state, a pretty substantial number of providers opening, but many are still closed, and their overhead costs aren't going away. You know, if you've got a center, you'd be lucky if your landlord's willing to defer rent, or if you're able to push back a mortgage payment. At this point, it's been months, and those bills are piling up.
Yeah. Nina, what would you say about what it takes to survive in this moment right now? I'm guessing from what you've already told us that just finding a workforce that will show up and will be reliable is definitely part of the picture.
The thing is, I have to now reinvent myself. I have to reach out to corporate America, HR. I'm letting them know that I'm here in the community. And if they need any childcare service, because they have employees, and how can we partner together that I will meet those hours for them. So the other market that I was trying to reach out to, the at-risk population over here, they're not even qualifying or able to get on DHS if I can even get the payments to be able to pay me. So I have to look towards corporate and see how we can partner together, because as Kobe mentioned, people have mortgages and they have rent to pay, and it's just not going to add up. Some of the child care centers only have 5 children sitting there, and you still got to cut your lights, your gas, same operation costs, and serve the food and have the cook there to cook the food.
What are you hearing from the families who used to come to you about why they're not coming back?
So I have a little girl that has some illness, and so her mother, she had a scholarship. So she had to turn down a scholarship because she's afraid to bring her child in this environment, which I have the social distance signs. Parents are not coming in. We have virtual tours on our website. You have another lady that she just preferred her son to stay at home, you know, instead of interacting, social development and everything. So those are their own fears that they have. They don't want to bring their children out in this environment.
Right. Kobe, is there anything that you're hearing about across the system? You know, are people maybe just having to rely on their families a bit more, or worse yet, maybe, you know, just, trying to get other siblings asking older kids to look after themselves as they can?
Yeah, so there's an element of that, you know, especially as kids have been out of school. We also need to remember that the unemployment rate has spiked to historic levels. You know, earlier in the year, it's still quite high. You've got more parents at home. You've got more parents working from home. So there's also practical fact that people are at home, and for reasons outside of their control, may be more able to care for their children.
Can I piggyback on Kobe? I just want to
please,
say,
please, yes.
And you have to be mindful that if the children in the city of Detroit, having them stay at home is very dangerous. You know, you got 10-year-olds watching the 7-year-olds or 3-year-olds or 2-year-olds. They need to be in an environment that's safe for them while their mothers or parents are out working. And they're doing virtual learning. And so I'm opening my doors and allowing them to come in to do virtual learning and partnering with 5 different schools in regards to that, because it's just not safe for the parents. And I want to provide for them the recess, the lunch, and safety, and help them while they do their virtual learning, because being at home, it's going to be a challenge to just sit at home and get this learning done for school year.
For sure. Nina, do you anticipate that any of these families will be coming back before there's some sort of vaccine available?
It's basically about the unemployment. So I am out here putting lawn signs out, meeting people, going to the food pantries, because I have to meet new clients now. I have to go talk to new families.
Right.
If I see a family out or anything like that, giving out the flyers, doing direct mail, because maybe my old families are pretty much scared of this pandemic. So I'm meeting new families. I have new families here now.
If you're just joining us, my guests today are Nina Hodge. She's a child care provider at Above and Beyond Learning in Detroit. We're also talking with reporter Kobe Levin of Chalkbeat Detroit. Nina, I think a lot of people may not be aware of how the qualified child care providers in Michigan are reimbursed for their work. In a nutshell, under the system that we have right now, the state reimburses a fraction of the cost of child care. Anyone who's ever paid a babysitter on a Friday or Saturday night can tell you that the top rate that's available for infant care right now, $5.80 an hour for those who are in the system, is far below market rate, much less what you'd pay for somebody who, you know, who actually has a background in early child development, you know, and some grounding in this. First of all, how did you make this work before COVID even happened?
So before COVID began, it was like I have a pre-K program. So that's a state-ran program for GSRP. So they give me set amount of money throughout each month. So that's going, you know, with my budget. And then I have my child care in my other building. So that still worked out for the dollar amount for the staff that I had over there. So I knew the projection every month what I was receiving.
Nina, you're part of a group that's called Providers for Change that's organizing to ask lawmakers in Lansing for some assistance. What kinds of things are you working on trying to tell lawmakers that you need to get through this?
So it's only 2 main things that we want to start off with. Just pay us the weekly rate. You know, that's other states that's getting paid, that so we can help us towards our operation costs. And also they have this start rated thing right now, and I think we should eliminate that right now. Because, you know, you star rating, everybody should get equal pay.
Right. Kobe, could you read the tea leaves for a minute and maybe tell what you know of the situation in Lansing and maybe how likely it is that child care providers might get some relief?
Sure. So we need to think about not just Lansing, but Washington. I think if you talk to folks who are, you know, advocating for child care providers in the state, they'll say that all eyes are really on the federal government right now. There are talks going on in D.C. About the potential of another coronavirus relief package that could include some direct aid for child care providers like Ms. Hodge. In order for the state to fill the gap that we're seeing for child care providers, they would actually have to increase their funding. And what you have to realize is the state budget is in really rough shape. They're talking about cuts, not increases for any program. The lucky programs, folks are saying in Lansing, are the ones that won't get cut. But in order to really preserve childcare, they would have to substantially increase their level of support for childcare providers. I've spoken to some legislators who like that idea, who would like to throw a lifeline to childcare providers. Say, you know, in this budget cycle, it's a really heavy lift. So, you know, my crystal ball is broken. The pandemic broke it. But I would say that if childcare providers are looking for additional help, it may be wisest to look to either DC or to, you know, potentially private sources who have already begun to step in to help providers stay afloat and provide this service to families.
And I want to share with Kobe too, because I spoke to several different state representatives throughout the years, and they really don't have a clue about how we were getting paid, and they thought that was enough. Until we had to sit down and show them the figures, and they like, wow, this is what you guys getting paid. Yes. So it never became on someone's agenda to say, look, we need to go look at this again, because these are essential workers out here that's providing quality care to people that's going to and from work. And so I don't think it was any importance at the time to look into this. But now we're just seeing a map like this is not making any sense for the type of work and for our education that we provide for the families here.
Right. Kobe, is there much of a partisan split in how Republicans and Democrats might be predisposed to take some action on this?
So across the country, childcare has really been a remarkably bipartisan issue at a time of you know, extreme partisan polarization generally. I think folks recognize that in every part of Michigan, you know, in every socioeconomic level, folks need childcare. Childcare is expensive for everyone because the way the system works now, basically, if you live in a wealthier neighborhood, you're paying a lot more for childcare. Everyone pays what they can afford through the market system that they have now. And the result is that it's not affordable for anyone. While providers, especially those in low-income communities who are just getting you know, the small state subsidies and whatever else their parents are able to add, are struggling to pay teachers. We need to say that providers often can't pay their teachers above poverty levels. So, you know, teachers in subsidized childcare programs might have children that qualify for those subsidies themselves.
Mm. I wanted to ask one last question to whoever wants to field it. What are the potential consequences of closures in Detroit and beyond? Nina, what are your thoughts on that?
I think now that the providers for change is coming together and sitting down talking to our state reps, I reached out to Republicans, Democrats. This is an issue across the state of Michigan. Because we are essential for everyone in order for them to go to work. So I think it's going to come about. But is it going to come overnight? Absolutely not. And so I just want us to get on board now for they can look at these figures, dollar amount, and try to. And I mentioned that to Kobe, too, that they paid us. They paid us when our doors were closed, even if the kids weren't here or not. So I don't know why it cannot continue to pay us until we get really out of this pandemic, until almost to the end of the year, you know, for the children that we have here. Because they paid us for every child that said that wasn't even in our building. And we got paid. So something's going to come together if we work together to get this resolved.
Kobe Levin, what are your thoughts about a future with fewer providers in Michigan?
So it's not sustainable. Folks in every part of the state, red or blue, rich or poor, people need childcare. If they're going to work, they need childcare. Employers recognize it. Educators recognize it. As one advocate told me, there is no economic recovery from the coronavirus pandemic without childcare, period. So this is something that we as a society have got to figure out. And so if a lot of childcare providers close, it's going to raise a big question for us. What do we do next? How can we make sure that parents have a place that's supportive and nurturing to send their children during the day?
Kobe Levin is a reporter with Chalkbeat Detroit. We've also been speaking with Nina Hodge, the owner of Above and Beyond Learning in Detroit. I want to thank you both so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
To survive the pandemic, a lot of businesses are having to get creative. For one Michigan woman, that meant learning how to sew face masks.
I sat down and actually made the first four by hand because I did not own a sewing machine and I did not know how to operate a sewing machine, but I thought I'd give it a shot.
We'll meet her in a moment on Stateside. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Your mask collection. I'm guessing at this point you maybe have a mix of store-bought and homemade masks. Perhaps you have stitched up a few for yourself. Maybe mom or grandma has been putting in a little time over the singer a few hours a week. Just as an aside, thank you, Nan. Thank you, Diane. Needless to say, demand for masks in Michigan has been intense this year. While sales of factory-made masks are brisk, there's still a strong demand for the home-sewn product. Amy Wisneski is among those trying to fill the void. She lives in Freeland, midway between Midland and Saginaw, and she joins us now. Amy Wisneski, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you.
At the end of last year, if we had asked you what you do for a living, what would you have said?
I would have told you that I am a custom artist. I do a lot of refurbishing with old antiques, and I do a lot of high-end residential, and I'm in a lot of homes doing custom painting work of all kinds.
And how is that business working out these days?
Well, let's just say it's taken a back seat for the last 4 months due to COVID, and I am now making masks around the clock.
Wow.
Although the painting business has picked up some since Memorial Weekend, actually.
When did you sew your first mask?
I started the first mask on March 20th. That was the first time I sat down and actually made the first four by hand because I did not own a sewing machine and I did not know how to operate a sewing machine, but I thought I'd give it a shot.
How'd it go?
It went good. It was a slow, tedious process, but I made the first pattern and it was great. And I thought, let's give this a shot and see what everybody thinks. Showed the mask to some family. They thought it was a great idea. Decided to post it onto Facebook. And within 4 minutes, my inbox was exploding. How do I get it? How much? What patterns? It was crazy.
Wow. So as you mentioned, you didn't really have a background in sewing. How did you teach yourself how to do this?
Well, my cousin, who's a business mentor of mine, is the one who really kind of got the ball rolling and just sent me the information on how we were in such dire need. I mean, the hospitals needed masks with everything that was going on. So he sent me some information. So that's kind of essentially how it started. So I just started reading and decided, I'm going to try this. So I started looking and surfing YouTube on tutorials as to how to make a mask, found a pattern that I thought, okay, this looks pretty easy for somebody who has no clue how to sew, picked up some materials from Joann's, and that's when I made the first four. And like I said, it was fairly easy to do. And then once the inbox hit with, oh my gosh, there's like over 40 some orders. I called my cousin the next day and I said, I'm going to need to get a sewing machine. And so that's kind of how that started.
Just for my own information, what kind did you go for?
I have a genome and it is Tiffany blue and I love it.
Tiffany blue. That's yeah. Pretty high tone.
Yeah, no, it fits my personality. Let's just say that. But I had to then Google and figure out, okay, what's a good starter machine? Because obviously there's a lot of brands out there and a lot of machines. I didn't even know where to begin with that. Picked up the machine and came home, tore the box open, sat down with the iPad and the YouTube tutorial and did a step-by-step. And within 2 hours, I was stitching masks nonstop.
What was hard about it?
I think it was just I was intimidated by the needle that I was gonna somehow sew my finger shut. But actually, it wasn't complicated at all. It really wasn't.
How many masks per week would you say you were moving in, I don't know, April?
In April, wow. I would say at least 250, whew, if not more.
And what about now?
Well, since the one article went live this past week, I'm right back at where I was in the beginning. So it's kind of like the process has started all over. I mean, I have been consistently making them, but they slowed down to maybe about 100 a week, maybe less. It just, you know, just kind of depending on the week.
Are there things that you've learned about durability or just stitching style? I noticed on your Facebook page, you're full on with pleats now, which is, I mean, that's not beginner level stuff.
No, actually, this is the same mask. The pleated style filtered pocket mask that I have been making is the same one that I started making on March 21st. What I've done and what I've since learned, which has been kind of a fun process, is I have some customers that have required a little less material on the back, for instance, in the southern states when it got really hot this summer. So instead of layering them up on the back where they overlap, I have now just one layer for that specific niche of people. And then from there, I took it to the next level of, okay, kids need them. So we started with the small and the extra small. And then, of course, you know, an extra large size because some want a little bit more room. So we've altered that. And then the straps from the beginning, you know, I tried to do the elastic and it just didn't seem to fit. You know, it was either too tight for some or not enough. And so the adjustable is what I've been doing and everybody seems to love it. And I have a lot of repeat customers as well.
Amy, speaking of kids, I know you have a family at home.
Yes.
Are there ways in which this new business for you has changed your home life?
It has been a complete family process. Let's just say that. When I couldn't keep up with the orders, I had to quickly create kind of a team and I would be doing the sewing. My mother was doing the cutting. My daughter was ironing and tying straps. My son was cutting them and bagging them.
So, wait, how old are your kids?
My son is 11 and my daughter is 13.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, it's been really, and it was exciting for them. I remember at one point, my daughter coming into the room when the inbox was just, you know, going crazy, chiming between Facebook, my cell phone, the email. And my daughter said, "Oh my gosh, Mom, are you like famous or something? What's going on?" And I just said, "No, Savannah, this is just the entire world needs masks right now."
Yeah. Amy, how long do you see this going on?
Oh, wow. Well, I anticipate at least after the first of the year, I don't see things changing. You know, we're quickly coming up here on flu season as we get into, you know, the winter months. So I don't know. I don't see this going away for a while. Never would have thought 4 months in, I'd still be sewing masks, but here I am. And I'm loving it.
You were already in business for yourself when all this started, but has this new phase of your business maybe taught you some new things that you hadn't really seen or understood about it before?
You know, I just think for me, and especially for my children at the age that they're at, that no matter what life throws at you, I know I kind of joke and say when life gives you lemons, you make lemonade and you can't quit. For me, this was just something that no matter what happens, you just got to pick up right where you're at and keep going. I guess I just never really panicked. I just kept doing what I do and that's just can't stop, won't stop. So it's been an amazing journey and I've met so many amazing people along the way. Some who've become new friends and clients. I mean, isn't that a great reason, you know, that it's COVID? But like with anything in life, you know, life happens.
Get it, girl.
Yeah.
Amy Wisneski talking to us from her home in Freeland, where she is making masks. Amy, it's really nice talking to you.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. General Motors and Honda have signed a deal to explore sharing technology for future projects built in North America. The companies say planning discussions on jointly designed vehicles are going to start right away. The arrangement is a memorandum of understanding. It isn't binding, but the move is another sign of increasing consolidation and partnership in the automotive business. Michelle Krebs is Senior Director of Automotive Relations for Cox Automotive and Executive Analyst for AutoTrader. Michelle Krebs, nice to hear your voice.
Happy to be here.
How big a deal is this?
I think this is a really significant story. I'm not sure it's getting the attention it should. What we are seeing in the auto industry, and I think the pandemic has accelerated it, is that automakers are setting themselves up for the future that eventually will be electrification, autonomous vehicles, connected vehicles, all of these future technologies that are very expensive to develop because no one's done it before. And so we are starting to see companies join together and collaborate with their people, put their money together to develop these. Because the other thing is, there's no payback anytime soon on these. So the latest one is General Motors and Honda linking to do current vehicles as well as future vehicles.
So if I'm hearing you right, maybe it's more of a statement on how much it will cost these companies to design the cars of the future. Maybe not so much a statement on what it will cost them to build these cars, yes?
It's mostly about the development because we are shifting eventually, and nobody knows when that turning point is, from all of our vehicles being powered by gasoline engines to a future that is electric, either full EVs eventually. In the meantime, we may see hybrids and plug-in hybrids. And also the vehicle, we are looking at autonomous vehicles coming in our future, and then vehicles that are connected by, you know, to talk to each other, to talk to the environment, you know, to a lot of that for safety reasons. So this is the new frontier. It's costly, and there's not a return on investment yet. So companies are pairing up to find partners to help develop this and also help pay for it.
Right. The agreement says that what they're going to be sharing on are vehicle underpinnings and propulsion systems, and they're talking about both electric cars and internal combustion engines. What do you see each company needing from the other right now?
Well, it's interesting if you put the two companies side by side. So General Motors is phenomenal at trucks. They build and sell more trucks than anyone in the U.S. Honda is known for smaller cars, smaller engines. They are the number one player in terms of fuel efficiency. And if, you know, if we move to a green future, it'll have to be better fuel economy until we get to full electrification. The other thing is, if you put maps together of where they sell vehicles, GM sells the bulk of its vehicles in the heart of the country, the middle of the country. Honda's big markets are on the coast, which, and GM's never really done fabulously well in California, which is a huge market. The only exception for Honda would be in Ohio, where they have a ton of plants, and you'll see a lot of vehicle sales there. So they have different products. They sell in different markets, and they also sell at different price points. So if you look at GM, they sell expensive trucks, SUVs. Honda sells less expensive things like the Honda Accord, the Honda Civic. And by the way, GM has largely gotten out of the car market. So I would suspect we'll see some cooperative there. So there, it looks to me on paper, they're more complementary than they are overlapping and competitive.
Yeah, you know, we've been trained to think of mergers as something that companies do when they have an insurmountable problem. But I don't know if that's true here. When you look at both partners' positions, who do you think moved more toward the center of the room to make this deal happen?
Oh, that's really hard to say. I think they've been practicing for a while. I go back a long way in this industry. Honda and GM partnered back in the Saturn days on engines. The Saturn View SUV had a Honda engine and transmission. So they put their toe in the water back then. In more recent months, they have been getting closer and closer. They're working on fuel cell vehicles together. They're working on electrified vehicles together. And Honda invested in Cruise Automation, which is a company in San Francisco that General Motors owns. And GM, Cruise, and Honda are developing a little autonomous shuttle vehicle that we've seen that called the Origin, which will be autonomous. So they've kind of been working on projects together. So my sense is they decided, well, we can do more together.
Right, let's go for it. Do you think this puts them in a competitive position with respect to, say, Fiat Chrysler and Peugeot, who just announced their own happy engagement?
Well, I think they've done it differently. So Fiat Chrysler is doing a full merger with PSA Peugeot in France. And they have a lot going on in Europe, both of the companies. GM is not in Europe at all. Honda is a bit. So I don't think it's exactly the same. I think it might be a smarter move for GM and Honda. Honda's a fiercely independent company. But if we look at Volkswagen and Ford, they're doing a lot of the same things. It's just they're not doing it just in North America. They're doing work also in Europe. So it's a strategic alliance to work on certain projects, and that's probably a good place to be.
Michelle, we've known for some time that these changes are coming, with electrics and hybrids probably occupying much more of the market share in the years to come. But can you help us shake up the idea of how we understand vehicles being made? With these partnerships, would you expect to see automakers just thinking much more fluidly about their supply chain and who they're working with and for how long?
Oh, I think, and we have been seeing that. I think we're seeing more reliance on suppliers to come up with new technologies and be partners in this new future. And we are seeing more of these kinds of partnerships. You know, it's just so hard to know when that tipping point is coming. So there's a lot of work that has to be done setting up a supply chain. Batteries are a big thing. And one of the things GM Honda deal is they're going to go in together on purchasing. Well, you know, if you can buy batteries and things that go in electric vehicles in bigger numbers, that should eventually bring the cost down. Because one of the problems with electric vehicles is at the moment, they are more expensive than regular vehicles. So there's a big push on to get high volume so they can bring the cost down.
I just have one more question about all this. I mean, they're talking about operations all over North America. Knowing what you know about the position that Michigan plants occupy right now, what repercussions might this have for the plants in the state?
Well, I think one of the interesting things that certainly will be looked at is Honda is non-union and General Motors plants are UAW represented. So that could be a little difficult situation. GM has excess plant capacity. They've closed plants. They've, you know, eliminated some vehicles. You know, they still have a lot of capacity. Honda's pretty capacity constrained. So, I mean, I don't know this, but, you know, maybe it's possible that Honda vehicles could use a GM plant that's underused. I don't know. But there are lots of possibilities in that regard.
Michelle Krebs is an executive analyst for Auto Trader and senior director of automotive relations for Cox Automotive. Michelle, nice talking to you. You take care.
You too. Thank you.
And that's our show for today. Stateside is produced by Mike Blank, April Van Buren, and our director, Mercedes Mejia. Our executive producer is Laura Weber Davis. Interns are Catherine Newen, Nell Ovitt, and Olive Scott. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service at the University of Michigan. I'm April Baer. Thanks for listening. We'll see you Friday.